So this will come up again because my heart is full of it. But last weekend was with Tyrion at the Edmonton Folk Festival, and came away feeling like I had spent the weekend swimming in grace and love poured out on the prevailing culture by the Indigenous community. It's just the most utterly remarkable, soul-satiating thing I have experienced for a long, long time. It was incredibly beautiful. And one of the themes that kept coming up over and over again, and not just the Canadian Indigenous community, but the worldwide Indigenous community as well. I mean, the center of it was definitely this continent, but from all over the world, the message kept coming up over and over again that the things we have in common matter more than the differences. The differences are not unimportant, but the things we have in common matter more. And if you press into that any amount at all, you end up at breath. you end up at being alive, you know? And, yeah, that's all I'm going to say about that for now. But when we breathe together this morning, for me, this is a conscious act of commonality. This is a stopping point in my life when we do this together, when I do this with other communities, when I do it alone. There's a conscious stopping point in my life to say, whatever language we use for it, when we breathe together, we share life with one another. And it kind of doesn't get any more basic than that. So, let's breathe together, and then I'll toss some ideas out there for us to ruminate about. All right. On the topic of breathing, I often find myself these days in conversations with people that I think I could fairly describe as people that are having trouble breathing, by which I don't mean are wrestling with respiratory challenges. One of the mornings that we gathered at Mike and Ariel's this summer, we were talking about what humans really want. And someone, it might have been you, Shireen, if it was, I apologize, my memory of who said it isn't as clear as what was said, said that one of the things that we really want as humans is just to be able to breathe freely. And was that you?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. At least for me, I was really struck by that thought, not least of all because of, you know, the practice that we share around breath as a community. To be able to have the freedom to breathe, to be able to have the freedom, we unpacked it a little bit in our conversation, to have the freedom to live, and to live in a place and in a way that is without fear and without sadness. I don't think it's some kind of reach to say that that longings like that are something that we have in common with the vast majority of our fellow humans. And then last week, in the talky bit, we kind of continued our exploration of compassion, and I got a bit riled up about the ways in which my religious tradition, Christianity, has sent me some pretty conflicted messages about love and racism, in particular. And to sum that little rant up would be, in my life and experience, would be to say that the essence of the problem was that the idea that I could be part of a community that aspired to follow the way of Jesus, which was taught to me as a way of love, and so that I could be part of a community that taught me to follow that way, and that also held overtly racist perspectives towards those that were not like me. That was sort of the crux of the problem. And in my story in particular, the not like me, the nearest not like me community of any prevalence in the place where I lived was the Indigenous community. It was my Indigenous brothers and sisters. So I was part of this community where I was being taught that the way I should walk through life, the universe, and everything was a way of Jesus, which was a way of love. And by the way, those people are not your problem. Now, those people, the others in that community were indigenous people. It could have been a different story, I suppose, in a different setting, but that was the one and in my story. And as I said last week, I think I'm going to be working that conflict out for the rest of my life. Like, that's just wrong. One of the things that sometimes comes out of me as part of my own process in that, and it comes out of me here as well, is a deep disaffection for religion in general. you've encountered that if you've been here. My head understands, like my intellect understands, that religion is an idea. It's a thing. And so, regardless of my personal experience with religion and racism, religion is not the problem. A thing can't be the problem. It's just a category. It sits there neutral until we do something with it. So, the problem I was having was not because there is a thing called religion. The problem I was having is because of what a community was doing with their practice of that category of religion. What I want to do this morning is offer kind of an alternative on that critique that comes out of me so naturally, I would say, as part of my own process of trying to shed this one experience of religion and engage it in a different way. Because, I mean, among other things, as far as the CRA is concerned, what we're doing here is definitely religious. And, you know, if you walked in as a stranger off the street, you'd probably recognize it as that too, right? So, what I experience in this community is not flawless or complete, but it's good. It's often very good. And so, I kind of go, yeah, you know what? No, we could make something under the name religion that was good. It happens. But I don't talk from that perspective very often. I'm usually wrestling with the problems out loud. And so, what I wanted to do this morning was just bring a different perspective than that for a few minutes. I want to read a short piece by a writer named Brian Doyle. Doyle is an American author and editor, a celebrated novelist and essayist. They died very young and very recently, actually, a contemporary. Died at the age of 60 in June of 2017. Probably best known as a novelist for Mink River, a novelist about a boy growing up with a Martin called Martin Martins. Anyway, also the editor of Portland University's literary magazine and celebrated for that work. Prolific writer that I'd never heard of until I encountered this piece. And then I went, oh my goodness, I feel like I'm just starting to find contemporary spiritual writers that are resonant for me at this point in my life, which is kind of fascinating, right? I've spent my whole life sort of reading this whole other batch of authors, most of whose books I now confess I've given away because they're no longer resonant for me. But I don't feel like that chunk of my bookshelf, things are seeping back into it. And Doyle's going to have a place there. Couple things about the author before I read the piece. Bill Bears, this guy lived in Oregon in a not very large community outside of Portland. And the director of the library in Lake Oswego where he lived says of Doyle, he tends to be able to find the right words to describe things for which you didn't even know there are words. And I don't know if you have that experience sometimes when you're reading an author that kind of goes off for you, but you'll read a sentence and go, yeah, I've been trying to say that. I've been trying to find words for that for like the last 20 years, and there it is in one sentence. How'd you do that? And Doyle's kind of like that. And I think there'll be some moments for different people in the community when I read this piece where you have that experience with his writing. He says of his own writing, I would like everybody in the world to read my stories, and not because I'm cool or because I'll get money, but because stories matter. Stories are ways to jazz your life, and maybe that shoves us a little closer toward light. Isn't that interesting? So the story that I'm going to read, or the short piece that I'm going to read, first appeared in a journal called Commonweal. By the way, Doyle was also an outspoken contemporary Catholic. He said, Catholic is the language I speak, which is interesting as well, and a celebrated spiritual writer in American literary circles. This piece first appeared in Commonweal in October 2006 under the title What Religion Is For, and then subsequently in a collection of Doyle's essays under the title What If. And I'm more partial to the second title, but you'll see where they both come from as I read you the piece. Some time ago, I was in a pub in Australia when two cheerful men stopped by my table. They were older, friendly, both professors, and as it turned out, professional philosophers. Did you know that was a category? Anyway, professional philosophers. We got to talking, a wild conversation about how thoughts are actually electrical explosions in the brain, how genetics is a form of mathematics, how religions are biological constructs formed by the human need to gather into tribes and informed by the human urge for awe, respect, and prayer. But there, our opinions diverged like the Yara, the Don, and the Dee. I had to actually look those up, but I mean, they're basically canyons and rivers that in literal and literary spaces are very divergent. They believed that religions were only evolutionary urges at heart, whereas I believe religions are hints and intimations, lodestars and compass points, possibilities and verbs hurrying us home to the sea of mercy. The philosophers were brilliant men, and with words like inquisition, Shoah, and troubles, they flopped dark history on the table between us like an ugly shark. And yet, gentlemen, I said, are there not also stunning prophets and visionaries? Maimonides and Merton, the Dalai Lama and Teresa of Calcutta, did not Gandhi forgive his assassin and a pope recently kneel and apologize? Are there not more than 200 references to the holiness of forgiveness in the Quran? Is not the point of all religion to push us past our easy violence into some new country? They smiled. They demurred. For them, religions were merely corrals, gathering points reflecting the human urge to crowd together against predators, to cluster for warmth. Religions, said one, are finally no different than football teams and nations and sewing clubs we are made to collect in clans, and we'll do so on any excuse, which explains heavy metal concerts and Star Trek conventions. We laughed and soon parted, the philosophers back to parsing Kierkegaard, I to my own country. But I've continued to think about that conversation almost every day. I still have faith in faith, despite the philosopher's evidence that religions are merely nutty hobbies like being a Cubs fan, or Leafs fan, whatever. I keep thinking that under the rituals and rigmarole, there is in religion a crucial, wriggling sense of what human beings might be someday. It's what you experience sometimes for an instant in patriotism or sport or family, a humor and mercy, a camaraderie and ease, a grace and mercy, a warmth beyond all reason and sense. Sometimes, for a second, at a game, a meeting, in line at the bank, at a park by the river, you get a flash of connective energy with your fellow beings, just a flick of it, a quick shiver of inexplicable peace and joy in the company of your fellow travelers. That flash is what religions are for. Yes, we gather because deep in our mammal hearts we are in awe of whatever it is that sparks life. And yes, we are desperate for definition, so we drape explanations on the unnameable. And yes, we gather in groups because we must, because we are mammals just down from the trees, as the great American sage Peter Matthiessen says, and we are afraid of death, which is why we deliver it to others so easily. But what if, as Matthiessen says, our moral evolution ever caught up to our breathtaking physical evolution? What if? We can move mountains, fly to the moon, murder millions, and map the mystery of our genetic making. But what if we dropped the dagger, plucked the beams from our eyes, and grew up? We already have maps of that bright country, and we have them in the brilliant bones of religion. There are and have been many thousands of religions, stridently different, all flawed and greedy, but in their essence, all about the same thing: praise for the miracle of life, awe for the mysterious force that creates it, yearning for life beyond death, and most of all, inarticulate desperation for a future in which mercy trumps murder. More than any other force on this bruised earth, religions keep that desperate dream alive, for which I celebrate them and bow to what is best in us. Whew! That's pretty great, hey? There's a vision for us to soak in. In their essence, speaking of all those thousands of religions, in their essence about the same thing. Praise for the miracle of life, awe for the mysterious force that creates it, yearning for life beyond death, and most of all, inarticulate desperation for a future in which mercy trumps murder. This essay is old enough that I can't help but think that someone like Doyle, with his sensibility about words, might have phrased the contrast of mercy and murder another way in another time. But I think they're insightful to speak of inarticulate desperation for that better future. That feels to me like a really important insight. And I want to suggest this morning that although we may often experience those sorts of longings, we get down to this how do we get there part. And we find that question so complex and so distant in terms of its coming to fruition that we feel desperate in the inarticulate, in the face of it. We can get stuck right there. And yet, as Doyle puts it, in my tradition of origin, Christianity, I feel as though there is some articulation about how to move toward the best in us, toward what Doyle calls some new country. There is a path. And I think one of the ways that this all got muddled for me in the story that I mentioned at the beginning, where I was living in this world where two things that don't mix were treated as though they could, the love of the way of Jesus and overt racist ideas, that one of the ways that was accomplished in that setting and is sometimes accomplished in other settings is because we treat religion as though it were not a map to that better country. It's not the bright bones of a way of human life in which mercy triumphs over murder. It's just a category. It's just a thing you do a certain day in a certain place with certain rituals, and it doesn't spill over in good ways and in challenging ways to the rest of life. As I've said before in this space, I don't personally believe that Jesus came to start a religion. I think that if Jesus was up to anything consciously religious at all, it was the Reformation of Judaism. That's certainly what, as we have the story, what got them in so much trouble. But the stories we have about Jesus point us toward a really radical way of love. They point us toward a way of looking at one another as humans, at the heart of which is this idea that good, love, kindness, God, that those realities are in everyone, without exception. And when we listen to the people who are making religion out of the teachings of Jesus, right, in particular the writings of Paul, as we have them in the Bible, we hear Paul saying things like, if you walk down this path that Jesus walked, you're gonna be walking down a path in which the distinctives that we use to alienate one another don't apply. No Greek, no Roman, no male, no female. And he kind of just goes down this list of classic ways in which we would say, nope, not like me, and says, does not apply. That's intriguing to me. Because it's easy to find the obvious objection to this idea, right? That if whatever we use God language for is about goodness and love and kindness and all of those good things that we want to see and experience in the world, then all you have to do to kind of poke a hole in that idea that that's in everyone is just to point to someone in which they are apparently not present. Right? That's the objection. If that's true, if God is love, if God is good, then would somebody please tell me where that resides within? And then all you have to do is pick a person who's done something evil, or pick a person you just don't like, or just pick a person that isn't like you. Right? And you're at the crux of the problem. So, as I've dug around in my own tradition, looking for that best in us inside of it, one of the ideas that stands out to me is this idea of looking for Christ in everyone that I meet. Now, some of you who grew up inside the Christian religion have heard that phrase until you're up to here with it. I want to tell you what I don't mean by it. I do not mean looking for somebody that believes what I believe about Christ in everyone. That's not what I mean. I do not mean looking for other Christians or the potential that they would be Christians in everyone that I meet. See, the traditional Christian understanding of the Jesus character in the story is that this is a human being that embodies the presence of the divine so uniquely and so powerfully that we're still trying to figure out what kind of language to use for it. We don't agree, we being humans, about how to understand that event. Why would we? If the divine is a mystery to us in the end, and there's someone who's walking through the world the way we walk through the world, who is so connected to the divine that their behavior doesn't match ours, we're going to struggle to explain that. We're going to feel really motivated to do it because we want to press into this. That seems to be built into us. But how we actually do it, where we end up when we set out to do it, those things are not going to be uniform. Now, the idea that looking for Christ in everyone I meet is a lively one to me is rooted for me in this meaning. I mean looking for the divine in everyone I meet. I mean looking for God in everyone I meet. I do not mean, in talking about this, to suggest that I succeed. If you missed that, you really missed it. I mean just setting myself this task changes the way I move through the world. That's a pretty big idea, but what I want to do this morning is just open it up a little bit and then just kind of leave it with us to muse on. One of the things that helps me when I reflect on this or when I'm kind of like, what does that mean to actually go out in the world and do this? Is a short piece. I don't really want to call it a poem, but it's structured that way. It's called Looking for Christ in People. And to me, this kind of both sums up the problem and opens up a pretty delightful challenge. If I'm looking for Christ in people, I have to ask myself, what sort of Christ do I believe in? Is it the happy Christ, the tired Christ, the anguished Christ, the betrayed Christ, the abandoned Christ, the grieving Christ, the compassionate Christ, the crucified Christ, the angry Christ, the Christ who enjoyed feasting with publicans and sinners, but who condemned the hypocrisy of the religious elite, the Christ who attended synagogue, but who rocked the boat of the establishment? So if I set myself within my own tradition, the Christian tradition, a task like going through the world, through everyday life, looking for Christ in people, including the people that really piss me off, including the people whose actions I look at and go, that's just evil. Who am I looking for? If we think about the Jesus stories for just a minute, if we think about the stories as we have them in the Gospels, right away we know we are dealing with a remarkably complex character about which we can say relatively few definitive things. So let me give you a story example that includes this looking for Christ in someone. I'm not a person who expresses anger very easily. The other side of that same coin is that when I encounter somebody that expresses their anger outwardly, that backs me away, right? I don't really know how to engage well with that. It's really different than the way I operate in the world, so it's distancing experience for me. So, I come to the Gospels as a person in the Christian tradition to a story like Jesus just trashing out the temple, right? Turning over the tables, scattering the money, busting up the merchandise, really kind of having a little one-man riot in the courtyard of the temple. And I've heard preachers do all kinds of gymnastics with that story. I've heard theologians talk about that thing, trying to make it into something nice. It's not a nice story. All you have to do to think about the complexity of Jesus is just think about what's the experience like in that moment. Let's imagine this is a literal story. In that moment, for the business people whose businesses Jesus disrupts. They're not going, I wonder if it's a metaphor, right? Their livelihood just got turned over by an angry rabbi, physically, violently turned over. Their way of operating in the world, their set of assumptions just got disrupted. And not in some like, I wonder what the greater lesson is way. It just got turned over. It just got smashed. It just got destroyed. When I think about the complexity of the Jesus character in those stories, I think about that story partly because Jesus is so overtly physically angry. And he's angry about an unjust portrayal of the divine, an inaccurate, not helpful portrayal of the divine, the commercialization of religion, right? I mean, here's a religious industrial complex running full blast right there in the forecourt of the temple. Think about that the next time you're tempted to buy a Christian CD or buy a book, or you know what I mean? Like, this is sort of the same story, right? It's about industry, religion is industry. And Jesus is pissed and wrecks stuff. When I encounter people that are angry about things that are not right, I don't always know what they're angry about. Sometimes I just know I'm encountering an angry person. But almost always, in that story, there's an injustice. So Bonhoeffer comes to mind. We need to treat people, we need to interact with people not based on what they do or don't do, but on what they have suffered. Compassion, right? So then I'm kind of like, huh. If I'm having trouble seeing Jesus in the world, and I'm especially having trouble seeing Jesus in an angry person, because I don't want to be an angry person that way, I've kind of got a clue in the complexity of the story that that might be a really legitimate expression of the divine. There are things in the world that we should be angry about. There are things in the world that need to be overturned. But if you're on the being overturned side of that, you may well be someone who's just there because that's how you live, right? I'm thinking about the third generation person in the temple forecourt who all they know is their father and their father before them. This is how they made a living. They sold doves to people that needed doves for their religious practice. Where are you going? That's the Sabbath. I'm off to sell doves. This is what we do. And here comes this firebrand and tips over the table and frees the merchandise. This story will never get simple. And I think that's important. So when we think about the complexity of seeing Christ in everyone, if that's an idea that's resonant for us at all, we need to kind of address ourselves imaginatively to this question, what Jesus am I looking for? Who am I looking for here? Because if we were going to try to sum up the complexity of the Jesus stories, maybe we could say this about Jesus. We could say that Jesus was a prophet and a mystic. If by prophet we mean someone who could see the problems, could see the destructive faults and failings in human beings and in systems and in the culture around them, prophet. We could also say, I think, of the Jesus character in these stories, that they were a mystic. If by mystic we mean someone that could see God in everyone. Even someone that's not behaving in a way that appears to be good or right or true or lovely. So if we're looking for Jesus in people, or if we're looking, by which, as I said earlier, I mean the divine, if we're looking for God in people, one of the things that we need to address as a challenge in that process is letting go of our preconceived notions about who others should be. This is not an easy idea. None of these ideas are easy ideas. But if we do not do the work of letting go of our preconceived notions and our predetermined judgments, we are never going to be able to look for that particular form of that which is of God, that beautiful Quaker phrase that I'm so attracted to. We will not be able to look for that in other people. One of these tasks has to precede the other. It has to always kind of be the work we're doing in the background. If we can't let go of our preconceived notions and judgments of who that person is, good luck to us on seeing the presence of good or God in them. Because we're already done before we get going. This does not mean, by the way, looking for Jesus, looking for the divine in others, does not mean that we are looking for only lovely truth in them, in the sense of, not lovely was the wrong word, that we're only looking for nice things in them. What we see there may well be anger. What we see there may well be weariness. What we see there may well be, when the Bible uses the word for compassion of Jesus, and he saw them and had compassion on them, that exact text, which I can't remember the reference of at the moment, the actual word is gut. Like, the actual word is that this tied his guts in a knot. So we might just see the things in people that look obnoxious to us, or that look evil to us, or that look destructive to us, that tie our guts in a knot. The task of looking for the divine in them is to look at this question of why. What's going on in there that might be that of God in this person? And we might look at it. Let's take a large, egregious, cross-cultural story like the Bin Laden story and think about Doyle's reference to all that, those thousands of references in the Quran about the holiness of forgiveness, and his suggestion elsewhere that maybe Bin Laden would have been well served to read those texts. Well, maybe to read them, but maybe also to look at them differently, to look at them as informing the way that they operate in the world. I mean, I grew up in the presence of texts that were about no Greek, no Roman, no slave, no free, no male, no female, no white person, no indigenous person. But the imaginative understanding of the nature of that text got left by the wayside of the practice somewhere. Didn't get plugged in. Why? Because that takes me into the train of actually having to look at somebody not like me, somebody whose behavior I might not understand, somebody whose culture is not my culture, whose values are perhaps not my values, and actually look at them and go, Creator is there. The divine is there. Goodness is there. That's a hard idea. Easier bypassed. Hard to do. As part of this process, it helps me to remind myself that Jesus didn't come to condemn people, but to put them in touch with what I would call their true life. When I think about a text that kind of resonates with this, it's the Gospel of John, the thief, words of Jesus. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they might have life and have it to the full. So if Jesus' mission in the world was to help people connect with their true life, and that's a path that I want to follow, that's my mission. And one of the things, and this is not like let's do the right thing because it's good for us, but this is often the way this works, right? If we do the right thing, it is good for us. I think one of the things that can often come out of pursuing a path like this is that we begin to move with greater facility into our own space of spirit. We eventually, in these practices, these struggles and challenges of seeing the divine in people not like us, we begin to get better at moving into a space that is fully occupied by the divine ourselves. Getting in touch with God ourselves. Those moments that Doyle talks about, those little flashes, those little flickers that he talks about in the essay, where we have these moments where we just feel like, oh, there, that's it. That's what we're talking about. I can remember there's an indigenous music duo called Digging Roots that I'd never heard before, before the Edmonton Folk Fest. And they came on stage and they started into what they were doing, and they started doing their songs and talking between their songs. And I just started to weep. Like, I wept through that whole set. My tears probably looking at me and going, who did I bring to the festival? You know, I mean, tears are just, I wasn't sad. I was just awash in the presence of the divine. I was just surrounded by the thing that I would use God language for, being brought to me by someone culturally not like me, born out of real suffering, real wrestling, real passion, some genuine anger about the things that we need to be angry about, beautifully articulated, and just carried to that whole audience on a wave of, I would use the word grace. Whew! Like, do not try to convince me. Don't even, just save your time. Do not try to convince me that God resides in only one religion. Like, don't even start. That's just an untenable, unbelievable idea to me. It's way too small. Having said that, is Doyle on about something when he says, in all these different religions, all these thousands of different flawed religions that are all in the end, you know, self-interested, do we have the map? Do we have the bright bones, as he says, of the way to this new country? To being able to breathe freely. To live as though the world was not sitting on our chest. to be able to re-engage with that and re-engage with that and re-engage with that, I think requires that we are going over and over and over again to a place of our own where we feel like that place is filled with the presence of God. That, learning to access that space and experience it as full of the presence of the divine, of creator, of God, of good, of love, of light, whatever language we use for that, that takes practice. And one of the I think true practices that can help us learn how to go there is the practice of seeing those values, those features, God in the other. We learn when we practice this how to go to that space more readily and be there more fully. And that fills us up in a way that helps us go back into our everyday life with a little, just enough to kind of do that again, try that again, and to kind of keep going down the path. To me, the question, what if pressing into a space that is more fully occupied by love and then seeking to live out of that same space, what if doing that increases the odds of moving toward a future in which mercy triumphs over murder? What if? That keeps me going. That what if. That rich possibility. And that's where I'm going to leave it, with that what if. I don't think the answer is foregone. I think it's ours to wrestle with. But I think there's a rich, rich possibility for good right there. All right, peace.